And I'm constantly saying to senior people in the organization, can we just get to the point and avoid repetition? I want to know what the recommendation is, almost from the top line of the business summary. I don't want to have to wade through 10 paragraphs just of the summary before I get to the recommendation, and then have to wade through this, you know, 100-page report, which in itself is repetitive. So be succinct, get to the point, stand in your reputation. If you've carefully considered something and you think it's right, then that's what it has to be.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we provide shortcuts to excellence by dispensing wisdom, not just knowledge or mere fact, to an international audience of rising leaders. My name is Duff Watkins and I'm your host. This podcast is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which helps professionals of any age accelerate their performance in the modern workplace. On this podcast, you'll hear honest, practical insights that you're not going to find in a textbook, because it takes 50 years to learn these lessons. That's why we call it 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn. Today's guest is Alan Hazelden, who's formerly managing director Asia Pacific of a division of a large billion-dollar company called InPro Industries, a company that touches your life every day in so many ways that you've never heard of. That's not important. What is important, and he can't say this, but I can because it's my podcast. When he was managing director of Asia Pacific, that subsidiary was the international jewel in the crown, and then he left. Now it's not. I'm just saying. You can draw your own conclusions. G'day, Alan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Duff.
You, when you left business, you entered local politics. I've never really understood that. I always heard that was a viper's den. Have I heard wrong? Am I right?
Well, I think.
Be a politician now. Choose those words carefully.
I'm just. Yeah, I'm mindful of the international debate last night, so I'm not going to buy into that. Yeah, Duff, I'd secretly always harbored an interest in politics. So when I retired from full-time business, I had an opportunity just from a previous federal MP who invited me to participate in the electoral process. So I went through the selection and became a local government politician. And everything I'd ever imagined about politics at all levels has turned out to be absolutely true. And I think I might have said to you once, Duff, the fundamental difference between politics, just the fundamental difference between politics and business, is that you don't get to choose who you have to work with. You just get thrown in as part of the mix, and you have to form associations and working relationships with a whole spectrum of people that you would otherwise probably never have encountered through life. So it's a fascinating journey and I thoroughly enjoy it.
I know you are a diligent public servant. I was just joking about that before, but I try. Okay. I know you have 10 lessons for us, but I have two questions for you. Now, you've had a long business career. Do you remember your first lesson in business?
Duff, vividly. It was my first role as a general manager, and it was a small industrial spin-off from a much larger group. And I sat down to my first board meeting, and I mean, we probably had at the time 20 odd employees. It was a diverse sort of a business, a lot of stuff, manufacturing, distribution, sales, the whole gamut. And the director of operations of the parent company said to me, can I have a look at your organization chart? And I naively, having studied business and, you know, should have seen this coming, I said, well, no, I haven't got around to that. This is just a small to medium enterprise. We don't need an organization chart. So that was my first lesson, Duff. I was absolutely and quite rightly held down. So organization charts have become pivotal in my throughout my whole business career. And I think not only just notwithstanding the first lesson, the organization chart shows people where they are, and with the job description shows them what their responsibilities are. And I think not a day or a week goes by that we don't see instances of people that they just don't understand where they are. They point fingers in wrong directions, saying this wasn't my responsibility, and they may well be right, it may not have been adequately defined. And a frequent question I struck throughout my business career, Duff, was people saying, I'm not sure where I fit. Well, the organization chart puts it there in black and white. So, and it's a living document. It should be. It's not something that's stuck away in a manual somewhere. It evolves as the organization evolve. So I think place a lot of importance on that, and I'll never forget my humiliation at that first meeting.
You're reminding me, as I understand it, the organizational chart came from the military, which, as you know, delineates your rank, and in just one casual glance at your sleeve will tell me where you fit into the organization. But that originates with the original, with the Roman legions. And that was because they had a very much an hierarchical structure, and everybody knew where they fit and what they're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And I remember Professor Fred Hilmer of the Australian Graduate School of Management. It's worked pretty well over the last, how many centuries, just having a structure in which people can slot in.
Absolutely. And I remember in my early business studies reading for the first time about the so-called matrix organization, Duff. Mm-hmm. And I still wonder to this day how that works. I mean, because people need, they need, they appreciate, they work best under structure.
Every time I see a dotted line, Alan, on an organizational chart, and I see a lot of them, I said, I know there's going to be problems because.
And you're absolutely right. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, that's the truth. That's the truth of the matter. We've both been there. We know.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. Another question for you. What have you unlearned? And by that, I mean something you absolutely positively knew to be true then, but now, well, maybe, you know, not so sure. In fact, maybe you were even wrong.
Duff, you've got a habit of asking incisive questions. This one really got me because I think in my youthful naivety, I suppose it reflects my upbringing, I just believed in people's intrinsic honesty and goodwill. And regrettably, and much to my chagrin, and through really a number, and I wouldn't say multiple, but a number of instances in my business life, I've been confronted with theft, with fraud, with people who just simply won't tell the truth or commit an action which they know to be wrong and yet will try and deceive the organization or you into believing it's right. So that's my harsh untruth. I know that, unfortunately, regrettably, people are not inherently, intrinsically always honest.
Not all people. Yeah. Some people can't help themselves. They're wrong. Yeah. Which you're reminding me of an associate of mine got promoted to head a subsidiary in overseas out of Australia. And he's, I called him and said, how's it going? He said, a couple of months ago, I didn't even know what a forensic accountant was. Now I'm up to my ass in them because there is so much corruption going on in the organization.
Yeah. Well, Duff, one of the things I put my hand up for on local government was to participate in the audit committee. And it was this whole appreciation of the fundamental issues with some aspects of humanity that prompted that involvement. And it's been, and I guess not surprising as well. And local government right across Australia, and I'm sure right around the world, is beset, unfortunately, by corrupt practices. Mm-hmm. That, of course, leads into the whole governance issue and the importance of governance in organizations. And as I've gone through my business career, I've really appreciated, formally and informally, the importance of good governance in organizations, being able to hold your head up high.
You know, and that reminds me, Jeff Bleich, former ambassador of the U.S. to Australia, said to me that the dirty little secret of Silicon Valley, everybody thinks it's two guys in a garage coming up with the next best thing. He said the biggest funder of Silicon Valley is the government. It's government subsidies and grants. And without a government, you wouldn't have Silicon Valley. You wouldn't have those two guys in a garage, because that's really the reality of the matter. The reality of the matter is it takes a lot of, the government is a patron of a lot of innovation, is what I'm trying to say.
Certainly are. I guess that leads to that, if I can just interrupt off that current expression that we read all too often about people with snouts in their trough, wherever there's government money, beware of those that are seeking to get their hands on it.
Yeah. Well, that's the downside of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is. Yeah. Upside and the downside.
All right. 10 lessons it took you 50 years to learn. Let me just go through my list here. Mm. You say identify bad actors and weed them out. What's a bad actor?
Duff, there are people in organizations. I remember, in fact, attending a seminar on this very issue many years ago, but it just simply reinforced my own perception that there are people in an organization that if you're not careful, are acting against your better interests, against the better interests of the organization. They're just, using the word evil is far too strong, but they're just, erosive, destructive influences working quite often and usually behind your back. And it's very important that you don't try and just fob that off and say, oh, that's just a little manifestation of human behavior. I better get on with it. You really have to find those people and remove them because they are destructive to the bigger organization.
Mm-hmm. It is a sad reality. We've touched upon it before. There is a darker aspect of people, I suppose, mm-hmm. if I call it that. Yeah. And by the way, that was a rhetorical question. You know, all those bad actors, I can give you their names and their email addresses and their phone numbers, Alan, if you really need them. I mean, they're just some vile people in business. Yeah. However, I'm my experience, I'm sure yours, most of them are, you know, you meet a lot of wonderful people in business too.
You certainly do, Duff. Yeah, you certainly do. You know, just on that, I think one of the things as an emerging executive and an emerging leader is to be very careful of people who've been with the organization for a long time that also have aspirations to the role that you've just assumed. They can harbor just simple jealousy, and time doesn't necessarily assuage that. It can just make it worse. And I've experienced that a couple of times in my career. Mm. Conversely, of course, to your point, there are most people are tremendous. And the great challenge of management is to find where people's strengths are and to put them in those roles. And within that cabal of really good performers, there are some people that really make a difference to you, mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. longer to your business. And one of the lessons I've learned in business is to just identify those people and look after them. Because boy, when they're gone, there is a void which you didn't even know existed. So mm-hmm. look after your top performers. They make such a difference to everything.
Okay, now I have a question for you. Okay, so we weed out the bad actors, that's one. Two, appreciate the contributors. Now my question, Alan, is why is that so damn hard for companies to do? I mean, how difficult can it be to appreciate the people who are doing the heavy lifting, working the extra hours, making the going the extra mile? And yet, in my experience, the ignoring of the genuine contributors happens all the bloody time.
Look, I think that generally corporate life, business life, does through the system of promotion and always looking for roles and just the whole evolution of a business does allow management leaders to identify the good actors. I think the problem with the bad actors is this emerging, and I call it emerging, so-called science of HR. And I remember vividly.
When did HR become a science? I missed that one.
Well, you know, I'm sure the professionals in the game call it a science stuff, at least a management science. But I vividly remember a situation a few years ago, sitting with a very, very senior executive within the global organization. And we were talking about the need to just get the best, the usual thing, get the best people and get rid of the bad ones. Mm-hmm. And somebody put up this, you know, argument, well, we've got to be mindful of local HR laws and regulations, and we've got to be mindful of people's sensitivities. And my boss my boss's boss's boss stood up and banged the table in that time-worn thing. And said, you know, something to the effect of, you know, if we allow this sort of thinking to pervade our decisions as business leaders, we may as well just shut shop tomorrow. So I think that's the problem we have, that there are too many social and legal constraints that make it very challenging to the point where a business leader faced with somebody who's not performing just kind of doesn't get around to doing something about it. But they should, because the morning after it's done, the sun comes up and it's brighter than ever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Really important.
Okay, I want to take the other side of that. I mean, because that sounds like corporate life, turfing people out, creating unemployment. Because, I mean, I posted recently somewhere, most participants in any endeavor are within one standard deviation of the mean. In other words, they're average. Or as I like to say, not good enough to promote, not bad enough to fire. They're just average, and like a bell-shaped curve. Sure. So, and you can't turf everybody out, and everybody's not going to be a high performer. Seems to me all a business can do is give people an opportunity to self-sort, mm-hmm. which they usually do pretty quickly, in my mm-hmm. observation. Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very, very fair comment. But I think, you know, and speaking of the bell curve, I think the role of all of us, particularly as business leaders, is to shift the center of that bell curve to the right. But I'm not talking about weeding out people who are average or slightly below average in whatever measure we can care to apply. I'm just talking about the bad actor, the person that in your organization that behind your back around the so-called water cooler, undermining, you know, your decision-making, your authority, just creating dissension amongst mm-hmm, people. That's mm-hmm. what I mean by bad actors, not people who are struggling by virtue of birth, because you're quite right. One of the great challenges of management is to position people, recognize people's strengths and put them in it. And goodness me, humanity's got some incredible strength stuff.
Fortunately, we do. Yeah. Mm. Okay. Now this next one perplexes me, Alan. Deference, politeness, and humility are universal. Now, if they're universal, how come we need to discuss it? And by the way, that's not been my experience.
I suppose, Duff, the need for deference and politeness and respect is universal. The behavior is not always. Look, I remember for some years I was quite active in China, and that was a real revelation to me, that because Chinese society is different to Western society. And I remember employing a senior person, and he was essentially my right-hand person in China. He was, you know, when you're in a foreign country, you need somebody to bridge the gap between your world and his world, your operations world. And I always had some innate sort of concerns about this guy, that he was very, I suppose to use a colloquialism, he was very bulshy. Mm-hmm, and he would sit at a meeting and he would, if a customer or a business associate was sitting across the table and said something that my colleague didn't agree with, you know, my colleague would stand up and sort of bang his palm on the table. And it unnerved me, but I thought maybe this is just the cultural thing. But you know, it wasn't. It was overt rudeness, and it crystallized to me when we were visiting a business in out of Shanghai somewhere. And as we were walking out of the building, the quite senior owner of the business walked alongside me, and he said to me very quietly, he said, "You know, Mr. Hazelden," he said, "we think that so and so and so and so is a very proud person." Now, what he got the adjective wrong, but what he meant was this guy just doesn't know his boundaries, and he's impolite clearly to the point of rudeness. And I remember another instance, Duff, where I was in Tokyo, and we were taken to a little mum and pop tempura restaurant. And I'm sure you've been to Tokyo. The food in Japan is some of the world's best. And this particular night was no exception, but it was a very small restaurant. And the fellow that I was with was from San Francisco. And I always considered, obviously naively, that people from San Francisco were just by virtue of where they live, were worldly, sensitive people.
Because there's a lot of Asians, particularly Japanese, in San Francisco. So.
Absolutely, yep. And so I was, but within earshot of our Japanese hosts, this fellow made very derogatory remarks about the food. After 10 minutes of me sort of whispering quietly to him, saying, "Look, please just don't talk like this," he very loudly announced that he'd seen a Wendy's on the way to the restaurant, and he was quite keen to get to a Wendy's. So
Wendy's being an American fast food chain.
Yeah, you know, it just simply, you know, just Western fast food. I think, and then sometimes I would see very gung-ho people quite frequently in sales. And you know, Duff, to be in sales, you've got to be, by nature, a reasonably extroverted personality. But know when to be the chameleon. Mm-hmm. Know when to tone that down, because people everywhere don't like big noters. They don't like people that particularly espouse abilities that they may not have. I just think that people everywhere, from my experience through life, both in business and without, people across the planet have norms of behavior which are acceptable. They have essentially the same values. Everybody wants a better life for their children. Everybody wants to just get on with things. And if you push against that tide loudly and aggressively in particular, that's just not the way to do it. Know when to just be a little humble and show a little deference.
Over my career, I've looked for and seized opportunities to shut the hell up, and because and you need to learn to do that.
Yeah. Well, it's the old adage too, Duff, isn't it? You're given two ears and one mouth. You use them in that proportion.
Yeah. Well, and just on that, international business seems to have a certain a uniform, certain way to look, and a certain way to act, certain way to talk, certain way to conduct yourself, to deport yourself. Yep. And if you want to be in the international stage, you need to learn that. Mm-hmm. And you may not be born with it, but you can learn it. And it's not that hard. It's not beyond anyone's grasp.
I think if there were two words that you could use that would sum it up, it would be to step back. Just don't charge in. Just because you're from Australia or the United States or Great Britain or the Federal Republic of Germany, just don't assume that that gives you some right to tell other people in maybe less developed nations how to do things, how to act.
Because you're a white Westerner doesn't give you authority.
Yeah. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. It doesn't.
Mm-hmm. All right. Lesson number four, keep looking out. I'm not quite sure what you mean by that.
Well, again, early in my career, Duff, I read a book. I was told to read this book by Theodore Levitt, who I'm sure you're well acquainted with.
Harvard professor, marketing guru,
He wrote this book called Marketing Myopia. I've never forgotten it. One of those business books, you think, this is going to be a chore. And it was riveting. And I remember the lessons to this day. And it simply says, we all get bound in our own little constricted world. And, I remember people saying to me, happened to be in the fluid power industry for a while. And somebody said to me, once you're in that, you'll get hydraulic oil in your veins and it'll never leave you. And that's just simply not true. But what it's saying is that people just get constricted by their own particular industry and their world. And if you don't look out, there are seismic shifts all the time. In fact, they're probably accelerating. They've been accelerating from the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, probably even before then. But be aware of what's happening out there. Don't assume that your product line or your processes are sacrosanct, that that there's not something that's coming at you. And I'm sure anybody watching this podcast would sit back and think, that's absolutely right. Why does he have to say it? But it's true, because we just get constrained by our own little world. That's what strategic planning is all about. That's why it's so important.
I posted something recently. Was there a business that was prepared, that actually planned for COVID-19, the pandemic? And yes, there was. Mm-hmm. And because they do strategic war game planning. And one of the scenarios they had was, just trying to think of the company, by the way, I think it was AT&T. They actually did war planning for pandemic. Then all of a sudden, March 2020 rolled around and it happened. So they had a plan. Mm-hmm. How are their profits doing? Very well, because they had a plan. They actually schemed for it. Mm-hmm. They schemed for a lot of things. But that's the kind of planning, the strategizing, if that's the word, that companies need to do, because things change fast, as we all found out. This is March, we're in October 2020 now, but when pandemic erupted, I mean, just like that, our society changed. I am amazed at how quickly business, social interactions change, how rapidly it'll happen. Yeah, and those things you can't plan for. A lot of things happen that you cannot plan for because you simply don't have the foresight, et cetera.
You don't. Well, the resources to plan for it. But I guess my central point is, just continue to just look out, look beyond your immediate horizon. What are the potential social, strategic, technological issues that are emerging that may derail your whole business existence?
My take on that is wonder. Allow yourself to wonder what could happen, what might happen. Okay, here's one I got to contest with you. Point number five, never lose sight of the detail. This sounds like a micromanager to me. And
sounds like an engineer speaking.
Which you happen to be.
yeah, that's my background. Duff, I think... I mean, we can't read too much into that statement. Detail is you know, down to the minutiae, or it's to the, you know, it's some intermediate level. And now I guess that's what I mean. But unless you know what your organization is providing to the customer, you cannot effectively manage it. You can't place your people properly. You can't invest properly. You have to know really what's going on. And the bigger the organization becomes, the more complex that task becomes. But credible managers, credible with credibility, not only within their staff, but most importantly within their customer base, can respond quickly to things. And there's a political analogy for this. The minister who's caught by the media that doesn't know about the details of about something which has burst in the last 24 hours looks like the proverbial deer in the headlights. And that's not to say that they have to know every aspect, but they have to know what's going on, what the issues are surrounding it. I remember vividly a colleague of mine that I went through university with. I walked into his, he was heading up a manufacturing operation. And the first time I walked into his office, I was on a visit, I was just struck by this completely clean desk in contrast to mine, which was littered with just stuff. And I said to him, I said, oh boy, you know, you've got to, you know, you work in a different environment than what I do. And he said, well, it's not, you know, it's not necessary to be involved in the detail, Alan. He said, you just simply delegate everything. Well, you know, unfortunately, the organization didn't last very much longer than that. And I think one of the reasons that it didn't was that he didn't really know what was going on. He just thought it was just there to be a, you know, put a tie on and have a presence. That's not what it's about.
This is the, I think you're right, by the way, and at least in my experience. And the reason why, as you know, I do a lot of performance coaching with senior executives and they're in a role. And I'm just thinking of one most recently in an international assignment. And the idea is you want to empower people and you want to delegate things, give them latitude to do their job. The trouble is they don't bloody do it. They keep screwing it up, you know, so you can delegate and they don't deliver. And that was the problem that this guy, the guy I'm working with, he's getting hammered by the CEO to delegate more. And he delegates, but it doesn't get done. And so whatever they say, you're paid to know what's going on in your business and your fiefdom, wherever you are.
And I think also, Duff, if you demonstrate an understanding of the detail, your credibility with all the stakeholders of the business it rises enormously. Conversely, if you don't know, like the politician, that's not across his brief, you're on the back foot from day one. So that's why I think the detail is important.
The unspoken thing about that, by the way, is it takes exertion. It takes your exertion, physical, mental, emotional, psychological, to find out what's going on in your organization. I reckon that's one of the reasons why people don't. They either can't be bothered or they don't think it's important, but you will have to make an effort to understand what's happening across, whether it's walking the factory floor or talking to people or
part of it. Duff, actually, that's a very, very good point you've made. I should be interviewing you. That's a very good point. It does require exertion. Because it's easy not to do it. It's easy just to tick the boxes.
Well, and the difficulty is the cost of acquiring accurate information is high, because it takes it takes some effort, takes some exertion, and that's why they used to call it management by walking around, but walking around won't do you much good. But you have to engage and interact with people who know more or know different than you.
You've touched on you've triggered another thought of mine too, Duff, about this management by walking around. I had a boss once, and I was at the plant, the head office plant, and very large plant, probably 800, 900 people on the site. And I was being given a tour of this plant by my then boss, and we came across a particular division, a particular activity, and the lead guy there, the manager of this operation, had been with the company, as I subsequently found out, about 35 or 40 years, who really knew this stuff. My boss didn't even know who he was. Now, to me, that was an example of just lack of immersing yourself in the business. You can sit in your office or wherever you may be, and you can fiddle with all the strategic plans and thinking in the world but unless you know what's going on, you're missing the point of your leadership.
Mm-hmm. And it, that knowledge won't come to you. You have to go to it.
It absolutely won't. No. So I think management by walking around was, although it is a time-honored phrase, it's not used much, there's an enormous amount of intrinsic value in that comment.
Next point, be wary of acquisitions. Now, why should I be wary of acquisitions? Beware of acquisitions.
Every aspect of human behavior and has its own culture, its own norms, its own processes, its own procedures. And nowhere is that more apparent than in business activities. And the problem with acquisitions, being large or small, is that people don't look beyond the P&L and the balance sheet. Let's merge these assets, look at the financial outcomes we're going to have, just forgetting that you've got to take people from a particular daily business environment and put them into a different one. You cannot expect somebody that's been with an organization for a decade to suddenly morph overnight between Friday and Monday into a new IT system, a new set of rules. Mm. I've never seen it work. I've seen some absolute catastrophes, and fortunately I've seen some which over time have borne fruit. But and regrettably, you know, there are two avenues for everybody wants growth. It's the tenet of business, rightly or wrongly. You do it organically or you do it by acquisition. And gee, people spend a lot of time talking about and looking out for acquisitions. Mm-hmm. But it's just never. It's never as simple as the numbers would tell you. So that was a lesson for me.
I learned that lesson from my mother. My mother was a banker. And when I was a little kid growing up, she worked for Bank of Eastern North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Then I was in high school, it became Bank of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Then when I went to university, it became North Carolina National Bank. And then it became, this is when she retired, right before it became Bank of America, which is what it is today, one of the larger banks in the yep. world, I guess. Yep. And I remember her comment as she retired, she says, "I ain't going through another merger." And I had no idea what that meant, but the message is pretty clear that it's not an enjoyable experience.
It isn't, in so many aspects. I mean, one of them, your mum's comment has touched on something there as well. There is incredible uncertainty that arises in both organizations, both the parent one and the mm-hmm. acquired one, because everybody starts to think, and they talk home over the dinner table at night, I wonder how this is going to affect my job. So, and it can be months before
you only need one managing director. You only need one CFO. You only need one, factory manager.
Yeah.
Okay. So companies don't think it through. They just focus on the P&L and the good side, and they don't appreciate fully the cost that it entails.
Look, it's just driven by this fact that acquisitions, prima facie, are an easy way to grow the top line. And everybody mm-hmm. wants to do that. Everybody wants, what doesn't matter what industry you're in, everybody wants a bigger and better top line and a better and better bottom.
Explain top line to me. That's a question I was going to ask about later.
Well, just simply revenue. I mean, we are driven in our culture towards improvement. And the traditional way that's measured in business, of course, is simply the top line and the bottom line. Those are two the fundamental guiding points.
So top line revenue, bottom line profit.
Yep, bottom line profit. Mm-hmm. And acquisitions, on the face of it, the simple way to do that, because mm-hmm. organic growth is hard, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but at least organic growth is within your immediate control. It's driven by people that by you and by the organization that you manage. So there's an element of predictability that's absent with acquisitions. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying you would never do acquisitions, but for goodness sake, go into it with your eyes wide open and go beyond the inventory, how the inventory is compatible, how the machinery might be compatible, how the customer list might be compatible. Go beyond that. Look at the impact on people and systems and try and imagine how would I think if I was a senior, top performing employee in my target acquisition? How's he or she going to react on Monday morning when their world has changed? That should be a fundamental part of the so-called due diligence process, way beyond just looking at the mechanics of it. The mechanics is easy. It's the other stuff which is hard, which makes or breaks it.
You're reminding me of something Warren Buffett does when he's thinking about making an acquisition or investing in a company. He hires two teams of advisors. This team he hires to tell him why he should do it. This team he hires to tell him why he should not do it. And then he listens to them. And because they're both biased and motivated, so he uses their motivated reasoning to provide him with a reasonably objective. Seems to be working for him. I don't think he's hurting for money.
I don't think he is. No, yeah. He's a wise man too, Duff.
He is. Yeah. He's a sharp guy. Lesson number seven. This is one of my personal favorites. Please don't give me data without a conclusion and a recommendation.
Well, we live in a world of data, and it's just easier and easier to just get data. But I think the analogy here, Duff, is from the customers want solutions. Customers want their world, their lives made easier. And actually, so does your boss, although you may not say it. So the very worst thing you can do as an employee, as a member of the business, the organization, is to present your boss with spreadsheets and PowerPoints and stuff without coming to ideally empirically considered recommendations.
That's pretty risky, isn't it? I mean, actually making a recommendation, that comes very close to doing your job.
Fair point. I'm just saying, you know, Duff, this whole data-driven world we live in, I mean, there is so much power that's flowing from the world we inhabit today. But goodness me, it's hard to sift your way through stuff.
Data is not information, though. I mean,
it's not. It's exactly. I mean, yeah. Look at Excel. The number of potential cells in Excel is essentially infinite. So that's what I mean by that. You've got to make recommendations.
Yeah, which does involve risk and courage, and really, I mean, and you could be wrong. Those recommendations can go wrong and can cost you, can cost the company, can cost theoretically your job. But hey, you know, that's what. Did I tell you the story about this Ricardo Simler in Brazil? He was the head of Simco, and he had a young marketing guy, and he asked this guy to do a study about this, and the guy beavers on. He's working late at night, and Ricardo Simler looks in his office, and the guy's working. And so after, I don't know, weeks, he presents Ricardo Simler with this document. And Simler looks at him, you know, on his desk in this big, thick document, and he turns to the front page and the synopsis, the abstract. He says, So you think we should do it? And the young marketing guy says, yes, sir, I think we should do it. Then Simler takes the document, goes over to the shredder, goes like that. And he said, that's all I needed to know. Simler said he never received another marketing document from that guy after that, which is.
Duff, one of my experiences in the working in the government sector is the propensity of government employees to do just what your situation describes, produce this incredible report, which is repetitive. And I'm constantly saying to senior people in the organization, can we just get to the point and avoid repetition? I want to know what the recommendation is almost from the top line of the business summary. I don't want to have to wade through 10 paragraphs just of the summary before I get to the recommendation and then have to wade through this, you know, 100-page report, which in itself is repetitive. So be succinct, get to the point, stand in your reputation. If you've carefully considered something and you think it's right, then that's what it has to be.
I'm going to give you an example. So I was actually going to, invited to provide a tender for some business working with the Department of Defense and something in recruiting and strategy. So I said, this is right up my alley, I can do this. The number of pages for the tender, the provisions, the cover your ass components of it. Now, I know it's the government. I know it's public service. I know it's, and I was going through it page after page, line after line. And I finally said, I'm no longer interested. I just can't even finish reading the document. It's so arduous. And now, Alan, the Australian Defense Forces are deprived of my services, and I'm so worried about the fate of our country. You know, but it just doesn't seem right.
Duff, unfortunately, though, that's not limited to government. I mean, there are, because of corporate counsel and because of the legal framework that we operate in globally today, even private sector tender documents are becoming more and more onerous, fewer and fewer outs, trying to cover every eventuality.
Well, contrast that with another submission that I'll finish tonight. Again, it's basically kind of a tender, and there's money involved, and you can win, you can lose. But their key question was the one that I use a lot. They said, "Tell us what we need to know." Mm-hmm. So they put the onus on me to tell them what I think is important, and I will, because that's the way that I operate. And that will truncate a lot of it, and it will be there are limitations in the form anyway. That is, to me, a much better way of handling it.
Yeah, too true.
So I guess my interpretation of that, my summation is, people, we get paid to provide conclusions and recommendations with the understanding that we're not always going to be right.
Correct.
And yes, you can make a $500 error, or a $50,000 error, or a $500,000 error. Mm-hmm. That's the game that we play at a certain level.
Yep.
And but still, that's the job. Okay, now I'm saving the penultimate, the best one for is the penultimate one. Mm-hmm. And all the performance coaching I do with people, if I could just get people to do this lesson, Alan, try to preempt what your boss would ask you to do. Preempt means do it before being asked to do it. Do it before being told to do it. If young people, young leaders, young managers could do this, oh man, career would take off.
Duff, it fits into the whole existence of a manager. Use initiative. Look objectively at what's going on around you. Ask yourself the question, whether it's a lean manufacturing perspective or a keep it simple, stupid thing. All this stuff is all about people taking initiative. How can I make my world better? How can I make my boss's world better? Look, a classic story that I've encountered in the last few years is a situation where a colleague of mine was asked by his boss to retrench a significant number of global people. And he agonized over this for some weeks and then came up with a well-presented analysis of where these people could come from. And he started from the perspective that he knew the impact on these people's lives. Nobody wants to do this.
Yeah, it's awful. It's awful.
So he did it, and he said, "I want to run this past you." And he ran it past me. And I said, "I'm going to be the devil's advocate here." And I said to him, "Why did I have to ask you to do this?" And there was a stunned silence. And this is what sort of thing. This is the latitude you've got as you get older and wiser, Duff.
Mm-hmm.
You can do this thing, because he said to me, "You're absolutely right. This should not have had to have been handed down to me. I should have been looking objectively at the performance of the group of people that I was responsible for. I should be looking at my own divisional results, and I should have come up with this." So, and it requires, to your earlier point about effort. Without effort, without emotional effort, intellectual effort, physical effort, nothing is going to change. Nothing is going to happen. And successful people have all got those levels of energy, almost a restlessness, where they are constantly of their own initiative looking for ways to make things better. Because by being better, everybody benefits. Ultimately, society benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my take on that whole thing.
Okay, that takes us to our 10th final point. Take care of the top line and you'll end up paying less attention to the expenses. Top line, are we still using your definition, top line revenue?
Yeah, revenue. Look, I think it's self-evident, but we become very easily enmeshed in that morass of stuff between the revenue line, the top line, and the operating profit or the operating line. We too often, and this doesn't contradict what I said earlier, but, about cutting costs, for example, but cost cutting in all its manifestations is a fundamental part of all business today and has been for many, many decades. It becomes particularly pressing when revenues decline. If revenues are strong and growing and doing what you hope they do, there is far less pressure to worry about what you're paying for your freight service or what your salaries and wages bill is. That's not to say that they aren't important, but if you focus as a business leader on your sales, your revenue from wherever it comes, there's a point at which there is less pressure to look at what's in the P&L. There should always be pressure to look at it,
mm-hmm.
but it's not the driving force. And I, this is not of my creation. I was told this many years ago by a fellow that I inherited a company from. And I've never forgotten it because he was absolutely right. As long as the top line was looking right, you could go home on a Friday night or you could knock off at work at night and commute home with far less of a burden than the reverse situation. So look after that top line. Focus on your customers.
Generating revenue covers and cures a multitude of ills.
Beautiful. It absolutely does.
You've got a resource to solve problems Now, does this contradict what you were saying about be wary of those acquisitions? Okay, I want to make an acquisition to boost my top line.
Well, it does, Duff, because acquisitions are seen as particularly the so-called bolt-on acquisition. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is easy because we already do this stuff. This is my competitor. Yeah. You know, acquisitions are ways to get big chunks of revenue. So on Monday morning, when the two businesses are beginning the merging process, you've got at least the short term benefit of that big chunk of top line. Mm. But with acquisitions, in my experience, it doesn't last that long before the issues below the top line start to manifest themselves and become big problems.
A shot of espresso for the organization's metabolism, you know. It's a jolt, fades pretty quickly, and there's no nutrition.
too right. You know, Duff, the other thing that's challenging in this area is being, and many people around the world have this experience. They inherit or they are employed into an organization which is losing its shirt. And this may not, the extent of this may not have been clear at the interview process even. Well, yeah, it's sort of fobbed off. And then on the Monday morning, when you turn up to assume your new role as leader of this business, you just look at a sea of red ink.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a particularly challenging thing. And that's where you've got to be able to juggle both the immediate thing, which is in front of you, the easy thing, which is to cut cost out of the business, but without destroying the potential value that's in that top line. So mm-hmm. all of these things kind of intermesh, and all of them require people who are agile, flexible, and to use the well-worn phrase, hardworking, because none of this happens without effort. You know, put effort into something, Duff, it'll wither away, and you won't realize it's withering away until somebody draws it to your attention.
Yeah, usually after the fact or after.
Usually. And it's all hands to the lifeboats.
Okay, I think we'll finish here today. You've been listening to 10 Lessons to Alan Hazelden, 50 Years to Learn. Today's podcast is produced by Robert Hostery and is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum. PDF provides webinars, social media discussions, podcasts, parties, everything. You can find them online, professionaldevelopmentforum.org. And best of all, it's free. All of it's free. So thank you for joining us today. Please join us for the next episode of 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we provide shortcuts to excellence for the next generation of leaders.